This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman. July 28th marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. The conflict resulted in more than 37 million casualties and dramatically altered the social and political landscape globally. It also influenced art, culture, medicine, and virtually every other aspect of life. Joining us to look at what originally was deemed the war to end all wars and how it has shaped our history is University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of History, Dr. Elizabeth Frierson, Dr. Ethan Katz, UC Assistant Professor of History, and Scott Gamford, Director of the Cincinnati History Library and History Collections at the Cincinnati Museum Center. Later, Asiya Johnson, who's the Public Relations and Social Media Coordinator with the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, will join us to discuss the center's online exhibit, Cincinnati's Soldiers, Men and Women in the First World War. You can join our conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Later in the program, we'll hear about how to effectively manage pain. That's coming up in the next part of the program. But right now, we're going to focus on World War I. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Frierson, off the air, we were talking, and I said the first thing I'd like to talk about the Summer Institute, and you said that's your baby.
Well,
so tell us about, just describe what the Summer Institute is.
Well, it's a baby that's been raised by a village, I should say. But in the summer of 2012, about 2 years ago, I sat down for coffee with Evans Mirages, and he told me about this new World War I opera called Silent Night, which just was on the stage last night and Saturday night and Thursday. And he was looking to bring more scholarly expertise to this great community building thing that he made happen around World War I. And so I applied for a National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Institute grant, which has allowed us to bring in 21 scholars, faculty and graduate students from all over the country who want a very competitive grants and fellowships process to be here. And they've been instructed by 14 of the world's leading experts on World War I, including our very own Ethan Katz here in the studio with me today. And we had two goals. One was to look at the war both in Europe and beyond Europe, which makes the war an even more enormous story than it already is to discuss in 4 weeks of intensive workshops. So we're looking at colonial soldiers. We started off our first day looking at the Harlem Rattlers, the African-American volunteers who went to fight in France. Then we sort of fined it down by looking at the fine arts, the performing arts, and the healing arts. And one way to sort of sum up what we're doing is that if you watch a movie or a television show about World War I, you would think the entire war had been fought by handsome white British actors, yes? It's a specialty of Masterpiece Theater. You would never know that one of the critical elements in the French army at Verdun were Senegalese skirmishers. And when the fog cleared on the morning of one of the critical battles at Verdun, the first thing the German and their allied troops saw were the Senegalese skirmishers at Fort Douaumont. And by that time, the Senegalese had won a reputation as fierce and brave fighters. You wouldn't know that there have been 1.5 million Indian soldiers in the British Army, and that of the 3,000 that fought at Gallipoli, whom you'll never see in that movie, wonderful movie with Mel Gibson, they suffered a more than 50% casualty rate. So that's sort of what we're about.
We mentioned the opera, and a little later we're going to hear from about the online exhibit at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. But, Scott, you also mentioned that the Museum Center also has an exhibit.
We do, and I want to circle back to something that Lily just mentioned, which is the Cincinnati Remembers World War I, a citywide commemoration of the start of the war. Part of our participation in that event was really two things. One, an online exhibit, which focuses on World War I posters in our collection. We have a collection of about 300 from the United States, Great Britain, Belgium, France, England. And we picked 15 that we think are particularly compelling and built an online exhibit around those. The other thing that is our contribution is we have an exhibit up right now called Treasures in Black and White, Historic Photographs of Cincinnati. And that contains a small section on World War I, some photos showing Cincinnati on the home front, or World War I on the home front in Cincinnati, and some related artifacts, which is our contribution to that. And I'm also proud to say that we hosted the Summer Institute for a day down at Cincinnati Museum Center, which I found fascinating, and it was very interesting to meet these people who are so knowledgeable on this topic.
No, we've been really lucky in our hosts. Our first day met at the Freedom Center, then the Museum Center. We've also had, I've sort of hauled our scholars all over town to show them what Cincinnati has in terms of World War One. They've met at the Public Library, at the Mercantile Library, at the Lloyd Library and Museum, at the American Jewish Archives, at Hebrew Union College, at the Art Museum. I'm going to forget one, of course, because I started a list today. They're meeting in the President's Garret at Cincinnati Opera. So, and we have just been so blessed with our wonderful, generous hosts, with what Scott brought to the table, with the Freedom Center, and at every place they've gotten a talk by our wonderful archivists and librarians in town, showing what we have here for people to do research on World War One.
Dr. Katz, let me work you into the conversation here. For someone like me who has been out of school a long time, it's been a long time since American history and world history in high school and college even, unfortunately. Sure. Just give us a brief history of to refresh people's memories of how World War One got started.
Well, World War One. Historians still debate what are the real causes of World War One. Sort of short answer is a kind of domino effect beginning with the assassination of Austrian Archduke Francis Ferdinand, which then led to a diplomatic crisis with Serbia, and ultimately you had a series of alliances, which are often referred to as entangled alliances, because you had on the one hand Russia, France, and Britain, and on the other hand, Germany and Austria-Hungary, and ultimately the Ottoman Empire. And these alliances, once one power became engaged in the war or became likely to be engaged in the war, then their allies were very quick to feel the obligation to join them. And so what could have been sort of a relatively limited conflict became very rapidly a much larger scale one.
So I think the summation that sometimes you hear is this assassination was the trigger, but there were a lot of underlying issues beyond that assassination.
There were a lot of underlying issues. I mean, one of the basic issues was this set of imperial rivalries, right? I mean, one of the ultimate outcomes of the First World War is that four great empires are destroyed by the war. The German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. Particularly in the case of the German Empire, Austro-Hungarian, Russian, but also the British and French empires, you had, since the late 19th century, growing rivalries in terms of attempts to expand these empires. And historians still often put a larger share of the blame on the German Empire and its expansionist aims for helping to sort of push toward the war. But the fact is all of these empires had ambitions that were leading them to be more willing to commit militarily.
Dr. Farrison?
Yeah, I'm stunned at, you know, I learned things by putting this together, at the how little we talk about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, the Russian, the Austro-Hungarian, and the Ottoman empires were done for by this war, and that was the end of the great land-based empires, which had been how we'd organize states and politics and power for millennia. And after that, it was the era of the overseas empire. But the Austro-Hungarian Empire had casualty rates that I believe were 70% of their combatants. Russia had almost 90% of their combatants. I mean, it was really astonishing levels of casualty. And this was also total war in the sense of civilian casualties, with famine, with dislocation, with epidemic disease, and, you know, with food being taken out of the countryside to the battlefront. People simply, they were eating mud, and this is not something on which we can survive.
Dr. Katz?
Well, we might just add that in terms of causes of war, in some ways, ironically, one of the causes of the war is the absence of any sense of what war would mean among most of the combatants. You had relative peace in Europe since 1815, since the Congress of Vienna at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And the vision of war for most European powers was a very romanticized one.
Yes.
And the belief was that the war would end very quickly. And so there was no sense of what a war on this scale would mean and the absolutely horrific destruction that it would wreak. And that is also one of the things that made these countries and these empires more willing to enter the war as rapidly as they did.
And I don't want to oversimplify this. I know you've talked about the empires that fell. The countries that were involved, go through those and how they decided who was on whose team.
Ethan.
This is these are longer stories than we have time to get into in great detail.
In simple terms,
you had two sort of major alliances that had formed in the early 20th century. With on the one hand, the Russians, the British, and the French, and on the other hand, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians. And actually, Italy was part of that second alliance for quite some time, even though ultimately they end up fighting with the so-called Allied powers in the war, with the British, the French, and the Russians. But these are alliances largely alliances of interest, alliances that sometimes are related to even royal bloodlines that went back centuries, alliances related to the previous wars that have been fought. The greatest imperial rivalry in Central and Western Europe at this point is really between the British as the reigning world empire and the Germans as a rising force that is really trying to compete with the British. And so a lot of the alliances came out of those two countries trying to make sure they had enough protection vis-a-vis each other.
We talk about that the 100th anniversary is coming up July the 28th, so that would have made it 1914.
Right.
I believe U.S. involvement came in 1917.
Correct.
So why did the U.S. sit on the sidelines for 3 years?
It was a great moment of isolationism, which had worked pretty well. We decided that our zone, our sphere of influence, was Latin America and South America, and that we were staying out of Europe's problems. And what's fascinating is how this story played out in Cincinnati with the German population, which until the outbreak of our entry into the war, were holding their usual Sunday afternoon picnics in the park, singing German songs of loyalty and patriotism and fondness for Germany. And then, of course, we know what happened in Cincinnati, which was horrible anti-German sentiment. Just the Germania building, I just learned, was uncovered this year to show the old German Gothic lettering, because this really was the destruction of downtown as a German area. Is that accurate, Scott?
Absolutely. German language instruction was part of the curriculum in Cincinnati Public Schools. That was dropped quickly. A lot of businesses changed their names. Of course, you know, a lot of street names changed, so it had less Germanic-sounding names. And there was just a general backlash against Germans. Those people of German heritage felt compelled to demonstrate their patriotism. Interestingly, I was just looking at a photograph in a collection yesterday that shows the front of the Abendpresse, a German language newspaper, their storefront downtown, and it's plastered with World War I recruiting posters and so on, you know, obviously, again, trying to demonstrate their loyalty.
We're going to take a break here in just a moment, but real quickly, the final stats on World War I, how do they, and I don't want to focus a lot on World War II, but how do they compare between the stats, the final stats of the casualty numbers for World War I compared to World War II?
Well, they're lower. I mean, I believe the World War II stats are approximately 50 million versus 37 million. The number you gave is 37 million.
37
which
million.
Is the conventional number for World War I. And I think that is one of the reasons that World War I gets a lot less attention in the American context than it does in the European context, than it does in contexts where the horror of World War I was so immediate, as it was for much of the continent of Europe. But the fact is that for Americans, World War II so overshadows World War I, and our entry was so late relatively that it doesn't have the same immediacy.
And we'll talk more about that a little later. We are discussing the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I and how it altered the social and political landscape. Our conversation will continue after this short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We continue our conversation about the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. My guests are University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of History, Dr. Elizabeth Frierson, Dr. Ethan Katz, UC Assistant Professor of History, and Scott Gamfer, Director of the Cincinnati History Library and the History Collections at the Cincinnati Museum Center. And joining us now on the phone is Asiya Johnson, who's the Public Relations and Social Media Coordinator with the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, to discuss the center's online exhibit, Cincinnati Soldiers, Men and Women in the First World War. And you're also invited to join our conversation, 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Asiya, thanks, sir, for joining us this afternoon.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So describe this online exhibit that you have at the Freedom Center.
Yes. Well, the exhibition, Cincinnati Soldiers, features a collection of portraits, images, and wartime propaganda posters from the Imperial War Museum in London, England. And it really highlights the unique and integral role that African-American men and women had during the Great War.
So when did the process start to put this all together?
Well, it began about a year out. The online exhibition features 23 portraits from the Historical and Philosophical Society of Ohio, and they were originally part of a larger collection of 200 photos that were taken by the official press bureau.
And I would assume we're saying that's an online exhibit. Is part of that interactive for the folks who visit the exhibit?
Yes. Folks are not only able to check out the exhibition online, but they're able to share what they find interesting about Cincinnati natives and how they were able to take part in a war that we had originally, you know, sidelined at that time. So folks can take part on Twitter and share what they've learned using the hashtag Cincinnati Soldiers.
And has this something that's been popular and been getting visits?
Oh, absolutely. It's taken off because I think a lot of folks are really interested about looking back and seeing the complete story of how folks, you know, banded together to fight against one great cause. You know, what I absolutely love about the exhibition are the unique stories, and that's my job here at the Freedom Center, is to help reveal those unique stories of courageous Americans of all walks of life in order to really give that complete picture of America.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but is there one that maybe you're able to share?
Sure, absolutely. I'll share our poster boy, if you will, Charles H. Payne. And he was registered for the draft in June of 1917, and he also trained here in Ohio near Chillicothe in, you know, southern Ohio. And at that time, the United States began to create military training camps, and when we entered the First World War in April. So over the course of our involvement, Camp Sherman became one of the third largest army bases in the U.S., and which were one of the few that trained African-American soldiers from all over the country. So it's a unique story showing how African-Americans were able to play, and it has a, you know, local fantastic connection.
And Scott, was there something that you wanted to add to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Asiya is saying. The photographs she referenced that are used for the exhibit are part of a collection of approximately 3,000 portrait images of area servicemen and women who served during the First World War. That collection came about because in December 1918, the Allied War Exposition, a traveling exposition, came to Cincinnati at Music Hall, and local organizers asked families of servicemen and women to loan photographs, which they actually had on display as part of the exposition, and about 6,000 people sent in photographs. When those photos were returned after the exposition ended, a cover letter was sent to each of the families asking them to donate that photograph or a copy of it to what was then the Historical and Philosophical Society of Ohio. Those are now at Cincinnati Museum Center's collection. And we wound up getting about 3,000 of those photographs, and that's the collection upon which this is based.
Dr. Farrison?
Yes, Asiya and I haven't had a chance to add to this story of African-Americans at Camp Sherman, but there were African-American fully qualified trained nurses who wanted to serve, and I'm not sure everyone knows that African-American soldiers volunteered in a higher percentage of their ethnic group than any other ethnic group in the country for this war. And these nurses were in the Red Cross hoping desperately to serve and go overseas, and they were banned from service until the influenza epidemic of 1918 broke out. And they had worked with influenza patients throughout West Virginia, and 17 nurses were called up from the Red Cross to serve at two camps, and one of them was Camp Sherman. And we have the memories, the memoirs of Eileen Cole Stewart, who served at Camp Sherman and said that the officers, the other nurses, and the men all treated us as equals.
Asiya, how long will this online exhibit be available?
This will be available all year long, so folks can visit us on our website to check it out and learn all these stories, because it's really eye-opening, and also learning more about their individual backstories and how all these folks really wanted to show their patriotism and add to the fight. So I think a lot of folks in Cincinnati and across the nation will have a great time learning these stories and getting to connect with these individuals.
And you'll find a link to that from our website, WVXU.org. Asiya Johnson is with the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we get back into the conversation, this continues on the World War One theme, but someone did email and wanted to know where someone can go to find out more about World War One besides going online.
Well, they can.
Sounds like there's lots of places.
If they're interested in coming down to Cincinnati Museum Center, they can visit the Cincinnati History Library and Archives, where we have wonderful manuscript collections and photographs and printed materials about World War One, much of it relating, of course, to Cincinnati's involvement.
Dr. Farrison.
Our public library, our fantastic public library, has wonderful collections of sheet music from World War One, as well as propaganda posters, and they would be delighted for you to come down and look at their rare books collection. John Urie Lloyd's son served as an ambulance driver, so the Lloyd Library has his handwritten diaries. The Mercantile Library has editions from the time period, and they also have an exhibit going right now from the Cincinnati artist Elizabeth Nurse, who could have come home. She was certainly wealthy enough, but she decided to stay in Paris and work with refugees and war orphans. And she has sketchbooks and writings about the war. So those are just a few of the places people could go, as well as the rare book library you see.
A few quick things here, because we're rapidly running out of time. We talked in the intro about the impacts. Let's lump the two of these together, the impact of World War One on arts and music.
Okay. Well, among our scholars this summer, we have musicologists and art historians. It's an interdisciplinary work. They went to the Cincinnati Art Museum to look at the German Expressionist exhibit and look at the change in art, which had already started to move towards the abstract. But as artists, including some like Otto Dix, who served as a machine gunner for 4 years, tried to grapple with what had happened, with what was being done to the human body by these new weapons of destruction, with having someone blown up and not even buried, but just melting into the mud, as many bones did, that they came up with new ways to try to express horror. We have a new culture of mourning in literature and arts. Film attempted to convey reality to really, mainly most media were stretching the bounds of what they'd done before, to try to encompass the enormity of what had happened, not only in the war, but also in the Spanish influenza epidemic afterwards, which also killed millions of people.
And what about medicine?
For the healing arts, we put on an exhibit supported by the College of Medicine and the NEH and University of Cincinnati Department of History that was about the changes in battlefield medicine. And World War One saw doctors getting the right to go onto the battlefield. British doctors actually had to fight to get to treat men and then to send them home for further treatment, because the generals saw this as an impediment to forward movement on the field, as a distraction, and it would, you know, untoughen the British male in the field. And they didn't want the damaged bodies coming home and being seen by people and cutting at support for the war because of what was being done to bodies by weapons that had never been seen before.
Dr. Katz?
Well, if you want to think sort of very broadly about the impact of the war on art, to sort of pick up on something Dr. Frierson said, you could sort of see two extremes. You can see an idealization of what it meant for these soldiers to fight that continued in terms of a lot of official art, in terms of monuments that were constructed across Europe, thousands of monuments to commemorate soldiers and, in a sense, to continue a kind of romanticization of war and of their sacrifice. at the other extreme, you had these kinds of very experimental art forms, like the German Expressionists, like the Dadaists in France, like a whole series of movements that were so shocked by World War One. And I should say quickly, you know, you asked this question compared to World War II. In some ways, the better comparison is to everything that had come before, right? The figure of 37 million was so staggeringly different than anything in recorded human history prior to the First World War that in a way we make a mistake when we could just compare it to World War II. So that context was so shocking for a whole generation of artists really across large parts of the world that they took to many forms to try to deal with the shattering of a series of kind of illusions about humankind.
Just quickly, if you'll both answer this, the statement was that this was the war to end all wars. Why wasn't it the war to end all wars?
Well, a British wag, and the way the British always are, a British officer said at Versailles that after the war to end all wars, we did pretty well at making the peace to end all peace. So they saw the diplomatic effort and the network of treaties as having created something there that was hard to break down. And, you know, yeah, let me stop there.
Okay. Dr. Katz?
Right. It's a very hard question. One is that the First World War unleashes competing ideologies in a way that will play out across the 20th century. The notion of self-determination, that's one of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, leads to a whole series of nationalist movements. But we also have the roots of fascism and the emergence of Soviet communism all in the First World War. And those are going to be ideologies that are going to fight very bloody conflicts because they're going to have global ambitions. And the second piece is the way the maps were redrawn, the way agreements were drawn up, were very much really in what European powers saw as their interests. And those interests did not necessarily align with the ambitions of the people in those borders in a way that made future conflicts almost inevitable.
Just real quickly, and hopefully I don't put you on the spot, but you're always looking to history to learn.
Yeah.
Are there lessons from World War One that we should be following today and we're not?
Well, as a Middle East scholar, you know, I think and many others in other areas think that the nation state is one of the most primitive ideas, that people of an ethnicity and language have to live together, or that people that live on one territory have to all speak the same language and have to be of the same ethnicity, to the point of Turkey forcing its Kurds to be Mountain Turks, of people in Syria being forced to live within these boundaries that were made by European powers, and something that Ethan just lived through in the last week, the conflict over what would happen to the territory of Palestine or Israel. So for me, what comes out of this is, you know, the arrogance of assuming that war can be contained, and then in the aftermath is this terrible notion of that's very hard for an American to understand, that one ethnicity must control one territory and that everybody else must be an enemy.
Dr. Katz, I'll give you the final word in about 20 or 30 seconds, and I apologize.
I agree with everything that Dr. Frierson said. The other piece is that the First World War is where we came up with the notion of making the world safe for democracy. And we have seen in the last 10 to 15 years of our foreign policy, a new effort by a group of people to, quote, make the world safe for democracy. And we've seen, once again, just like the arrogance at Versailles, that doing that in reality is much harder and often much more destructive than it sounds in theory.
We've been discussing how World War One altered the political and social landscape. July 28th marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the war. My guests were University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of History, Dr. Elizabeth Frierson, Dr. Ethan Katz, UC Assistant Professor of History, Scott Gamford, Director of the Cincinnati History Library and History Collections at the Cincinnati Museum Center, and Asiya Johnson, who's the Public Relations and Social Media Coordinator with the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. You'll find links to additional information at WVXU.org. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about effective methods to manage pain. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.